to Patients at Risk, a discussion of the dangers that patients face when physicians are replaced with non-physician practitioners. I'm Dr. Rebecca Bernard, your host and the co-author of the book Patients at Risk. Thanks for joining me for the third and final part of my discussion with nurse practitioner John Canyon. John has become concerned about the state of nurse practitioner education, and he tried working from the inside, working with the AANP and the CCNE. He founded a group of nurse practitioners to try to get clinical change without really achieving very much success working in that way. So he decided that it was time for him to start speaking out openly about his concerns. Recently, he published a report called the 2023 Report on Nurse Practitioner Education and the Need for Change, and you can find a link to that report in the show notes. Ultimately, what John lays out are the problems with the state of education, most importantly, the lack of clinical hours, which he says is insufficient. He says that credentials of nurse practitioners are unclear, which causes confusion, especially with credentialing bodies, which may place nurse practitioners in inappropriate positions that are not safe for patients, and that there are really serious problems with preceptorship or clinical experience. He also calls out nurse practitioner doctorate programs, which he shows are mostly not clinical, and he has a lot of concerns about nurse practitioners calling themselves doctors based on a non-clinical DNP. John offers solutions in his report. He says that nurse practitioners really should work first as nurses for at least 2 years. He thinks that applicants to nurse practitioner schools should have minimum GPA requirements for entry, and that programs should be more selective about who they enroll into their programs. He also thinks that instead of requiring a minimum of 500 hours, he thinks that nurse practitioners should have a base clinical hour requirement of 2,000 hours just to get some foundations, and then another 4,000 hours to work in different fields. Not surprisingly, John is getting quite a bit of pushback, especially from nurse practitioner leadership.
I'm sure they're going to get upset with me from coming on and talking to you too, but all I care about is making sure we move forward and do the right thing. And if you see a problem, one of the problems I got into when I first got into nursing was when I got fired from my first nursing job because I made three of my bosses cry and quit. Well, it wasn't intentional, but I came from a background of working in factories and things like that. So when you notice a problem, you go to your boss and say, hey, you know, we got a problem on line three. You know, if we turn the line 60 degrees to the left, our productivity will increase 60%. Okay. So they try it, see if it worked, right? Works great. That's what we're doing from now on. When in nursing, they don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear the problem. Hey, we need you to work overtime. Okay, great. Are you going to work overtime too? No. Why not? I'm the boss. Okay. Well, you can't mandate overtime. It's against the law, but I'm happy to work overtime. If you're willing to leave, I'm not going to do that. Cry quit. Same thing in the next one. Cry quit. Same thing in the next one. Oh, well, you're just a troublemaker. Right. And then I did agency nursing and was happy with my career again. And then I became an MP, was happy with my career again then. And then I come into this and, you know, I really didn't want to say anything. I really didn't. I didn't want to. I wanted to take care of it from the inside because I thought we could switch it, but there's too many people too invested in full practice authority, which is one of the things they yell at me about. They're like, well, you're going to ruin the chance of getting full practice authority. And I said, well, maybe. But maybe if our training was good enough, I wouldn't be able to do that. Maybe right. If the training was good enough, it wouldn't be an issue. Right. We wouldn't have to fight. People go, yeah, that makes sense. You know, or no, it doesn't make sense. Or maybe if we had studies that were double-blinded, random controls in states that were full independent practice, we could say for sure. I talked about in my paper, there was nurse practitioners who got done with NP school, started practicing and just go home crying every night because they don't feel prepared. I have one text me the other day that I just don't feel prepared. I don't feel like I can do this. I don't know what happened. I went to a cheap online school and now I don't feel like I'm prepared, but I've graduated and passed boards.
They were sold a bill of goods. And actually I do, like, even when we tell the story of Alexis Ochoa, we feel, my co-author and I, we've talked about it. We feel sorry for the nurse practitioner because she was told that she could do this, that she was prepared. She was credentialed to do it. She was as deceived as anybody by the powers that be for political power, for money, for whatever it is, for ego. And ultimately, it's time to stop with the ego and actually focus on what's best for patients.
Yeah. And you can't do that if you don't critically look at what you're doing. I don't know. I look at that and it frustrates me when people, you tell them they're succeeding, but they're not. I do lectures for NP schools too. And one of them is, I lovingly call Shit You Should Know Before You Graduate. Right. I went and gave this lecture one morning, and I was giving the lecture, and it was in an all day lecture. So I was eight to five, and we left at noon, and the students came up to me and said, "We've learned more from you in the first 4 hours than we've learned in the last year and a half." And I'm just going, "Really?" And then I walked out of the room at the end of the day, the instructor had a whole notebook full of notes from my talk, which is great. I'm glad they want to learn, but I mean, this is stuff they should have already known. Right. Yeah, they should have already known that. How can you teach and impart information, if impart knowledge, if you don't have it?
But that's also a problem with academics in general. Like, you know, usually they don't pay very well. People make a lot more money out in regular practice. This is the same in the physician world too. Mm-hmm. So the people that go into academia, there's maybe it's because they really have a passion for it or whatever it is.
Right.
But it is a problem in all of our professions is getting those quality teachers. Really should invest so much more strongly in those who are teaching, because it's
100%
for our future across the board.
Those people need to be paid a lot more than they are right now. 100%.
Absolutely.
But the flip side of that is if you're going to be paid a lot more, you need to make sure that the quality is there too.
High expectations and performance.
And,
absolutely.
And I just think that we're not close to where we need to be. We need more training. We need more time. And I think I talked to somebody recently, and they had one of the greatest phrases for this was, you need to slow down. You need to slow the education down.
Right. Stop trying to rush through it and do these accelerated programs, working full time and going to school. It's just not realistic that you can absorb the information that you need.
It's almost impossible. I did it. It's almost impossible. I mean, I got to the end of, I think I had 3 months left, and I came home and I told my wife, I said, I quit my job. She said, what? I said, I quit my job. I can't do it anymore. I can't, I just physically can't do it. And so I quit my job in the last 3 months. She's like, well, you know, we're going to live on savings. You're not gonna have any income. I'm like, yep.
And that's because also you're dedicated to actually learning the material. You have other people that are maybe phoning it in, and knowing that the criteria are so minimum, they might be able to skate by. But then when they come out, these are people's lives that they have in their hands.
You have people say, well, I never opened the book. When I have them as a student, I never opened the book. I don't need to. I do discussion boards and I write papers. That's all I do. Mm-hmm. And then they tell them in their syllabus that they need to spend time looking at Leak or Hollier or Fitzgerald. Those are the big...
Review courses,
right? You go to, we want you to go to Lee Collier or Fitzgerald, and that's where you need to learn how to pass the test. And I go, whoa, you need to learn how to pass the test? Shouldn't you be learning how to take care of patients? Right. And then passing the test is a secondary byproduct of that, not a primary byproduct. And then you have nurse practitioners who say, well, we passed the same test. Easiest test I ever took, by far. It was the easiest test I ever took. And the family nurse practitioners get mad at me for that. The emergency nurse practitioners get really mad at me when I tell them it was the easiest test I ever took. All right, it was easy. It was too easy. And like, well, instead of saying, well, get mad at me for saying that, why don't you ask me why I think it's the easiest test I ever took? What do you think should change in order to make it the appropriate level, to make it an entry level? And this is another thing most people don't know. Our test is not a mastery test. And so it's not a test of mastery of skills. It's an entry level to practice exam. So the test is supposed to be testing your knowledge so you won't kill people, essentially.
Mm.
It's not a mastery subject. Like when you take your boards, yours is a mastery level test. Ours is not. Ours is an entry to practice exam. So that's a significant difference.
I think one of the things that I thought of while you were talking is nursing ethics, because I think of the nurses that I've known in my career, the ones that were, you know, bedside nurses for a long time, and there is nobody that will hold your feet to the fire and make sure you do not cut corners. You do not, you know, you always do everything by the book. And that's why you'll hear nurses say, I saved the doctor, and, you know, and that can happen. And in part, it's because the attention to detail, it's the not cutting corners, and it's sort of like this nursing ethic. And I feel like that is what has changed. And if you never worked as a nurse and you don't have those nursing role models, and you never get that ingrained in you, then of course you're going to be like, well, I don't need to open books and I can just study for the test, because you lose that ethics, which is taking care of the patient and the commitment to the patient's well-being, which is such the core of nursing philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why one of my core tenets is making sure you're a nurse practitioner. You're a nurse first. Should have been a nurse. Should have spent time at the bedside. You got to learn how to be a nurse before you can learn how to be a nurse practitioner. Now, there are people who have been direct entry and are very, 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 very good nurse practitioners. And you know, and that's fine. But again, are we adjusting things and taking into account the exceptional or the average?
Right.
And I think we can't base our decisions based on the exceptional. We have to base our decisions based on the bottom and the average. And if you right. don't do that, then that's why I say, are you comfortable with any NP taking care of you? Because I'm not. And when I go see a nurse practitioner, the first question I ask them is, where'd you go to school?
Right.
Where'd you go to school? Because that matters.
And you know the difference versus mm-hmm. a patient has no idea what Walden or Regis or,
nope.
you know, Columbia.
Nope. They have no clue.
The differences are.
They just see, credentials. They see the credential right. and assume that somebody is competent, right? I think that it's the lack of clinical hours. There's a lack of training. And then they tried to solve it with the DNP, which initially was supposed to be a clinical doctorate, as you're aware. And it actually erased a whole bunch of the other doctoral nursing pathways in order to coalesce them into this thing. But the problem is NPs looked at it and go, oh, they don't want to do that. And there's no clinical. Why am I doing this? This doesn't make sense. What extra benefit is this going to get me? We all talked about it when the DNP came out. That doesn't make any sense. Well, then they're like, oh, well, by 2012, everybody's going to have one. Oh, by 2015, everybody's going to have one. Oh, by 2018, everybody's going to have one. Oh, by 2020, everybody's going to have one. And so all these schools are popping up. And then online, I don't know if you've looked at any of these online, but I have. Because I've considered going back and being an academic full time. So I don't want to get a PhD. So I figured that would be a way to do it. But every time I look at these programs, I just go, this is not going to benefit me at all. There's no benefit. But also when I look at the programs, they say, get your clinical DNP. Get your clinical DNP, your clinical doctor. Well, not really. You're not teaching anything clinical in the doctoral portion of this. So even somebody who gets their nurse practitioner DNP at the same time, they're not the same. They're not synonymous. They're two different things. The DNP is an interpretive research doctor. It's supposed to be for people to interpret research and put it into practice faster. That's the goal of it. It's not a clinical doctorate, but many call it a clinical doctorate, or they like to use the title doctor in a clinical setting once they get it, which drives me up the wall. Because they say, well, the DNP is equal to like a doctor of physical therapy or a PharmD, right? It's a practice doctorate. Well, I mean, you can call it that. That's fine, but it's not clinical in nature. Every single PharmD is a pharmacist.
Right.
Every single one. Every single physical therapist that's a doctor of physical therapy is a physical therapist. Every DNP is a nurse. Not a nurse practitioner, not a CRNA, not a midwife or whatever else. They're a nurse. So that doesn't impart any advanced clinical knowledge to assume that you can use that title. And my likening is very similar to, I knew a guy when I first started working as a nurse who was a retired economics professor who worked in the hospital he worked as EVS, right? As environmental services. So essentially a janitor, right? But he had his doctorate in economics, but his way of giving back after he finished was he did this 3 or 4 days a month. You know, he didn't do a lot, but that's what he liked to do. So because we didn't have orderlies and all that. So that's what he liked to do. So he came in and would clean and talk to the nurses and try and brighten everybody's day and all that. And a great guy. But would it be appropriate for him to go in the room and say, hey, I'm Dr. Hawkins? No,
but not in that setting.
Yeah, not in that setting. No, it's not appropriate. Right. And it's the same thing for me as a nurse. If I had my DNP to walk in the room and say, hey, I'm Dr. Canyon. No, I'm not. In that role, I'm nurse practitioner. And I always introduce myself. Hey, John Canyon, I'm your nurse practitioner. Very nice to meet you. What can I do for you today? You know, as opposed to, hey, I'm Dr. Canyon, your nurse practitioner. Well, that's confusing.
It is.
That doesn't make any sense to me. So I'm assuming you're a doctor. When you introduce in the United States, I know in other regions of the world, it's not the same. Like in, I think in Britain, they use a different term, different title. But in the United States, if you walk in the room and in a medical setting and introduce yourself as doctor, they're going to assume you're a physician. That's the assumption. And it's a pretty good assumption based off of history. And that's why we don't use that title in that setting. It's not appropriate. In any every other setting, fine. That's fine. If you're in academic setting or any setting that's non-clinical, happy to use the title. That's appropriate. But in a clinical setting, it's just not appropriate because it's not a clinical doctor. It doesn't teach you anything clinical.
Was there anything else you wanted to share? Any other important points that we didn't get to?
I don't know. I just think the biggest key of this is exposure. The more people who get exposed to this and actually look at it critically and can say, and you can shoot holes in my paper all day long. I'm happy with that. Please do. But in order to do that, you need to read it and see if it's, it's not the best academic paper by any stretch of the imagination, but it's the thought and the direction and the push for increasing the amount of hours, increasing the training, making sure credentials are easy so we can tell what it is. So it's not just a bunch of alphabet soup. So when I look at a title, I can see, like when I look at your badge or your coat, it gives your name, your title, and then it tells me what area of medicine you practice in. So I know immediately when I look at that, what kind of training you have, right? And it's the same for us. It should just say John Canyon, NP, emergency medicine, family practice, whatever, right? That way, when you look at that, you know, I'm a nurse practitioner who has additional training in this area. That way, you know.
Well, I'm not an academician, but I thought the paper was excellent, very well laid out.
Thank you.
It had it was very solutions oriented. And to me, it doesn't seem like the solutions would be that hard to implement, but it was going to require some commitment. I think it's going to require pressure on the leadership to make something like this happen. So we'll try to amplify the message, let people know.
Thank you.
And hopefully it will continue to garner discussion and grow. And I think that it's what you're doing is just so important. And ultimately, you're really looking out for patient safety.
I appreciate it. Anytime you want to talk to me again, I'm happy to have another conversation. I'll probably get some more people yelling and screaming at me
That's good. My psychologist, because I've done a lot of therapy over the years to, you know, learn how to start speaking out and speak my mind. He's helped me see when people get angry, it's because you touched a nerve.
Yeah.
And it's a lot worse for people to ignore you. That means that they don't care. So if they're yelling at you, you made them stop and think. And that is a huge thing that doesn't come easily. So
it's to me also tells me I'm right. And the funniest part about that is the conversation when they're yelling at me going, well, everything you're saying is right. Well, if everything I'm saying is right, why don't we act on it? Well, nobody's going to do that. Well, no, of course nobody wants to do it because they all want independent practice because that's their goal. It has nothing to do with anything
else. Even though a lot of NPs don't want independent practice, a lot of them write me and say, I like working with a doctor. I don't want all this.
No, but based on the training, I wouldn't want it either.
Right.
To be fair, now some of the states are doing it a little bit better where you have to have so many hours of proctored, which is way better.
If your proctor is actually doing their damn job, because I have a problem with these doctors that are doing half-assed or no supervision and just signing off and letting people do all sorts of nonsense. And I got a real problem with that. I call that out all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you just get in a situation where it's a no-win for everybody. But if you had, to me, our academics are very, very good. Good people for the most part.
Yes.
They just don't know there's a problem. And you can't know there's a problem if you don't get the information in front of your face so you can actually critically look at it. So that's one of the issues. The second issue is they don't know there's a problem, or they know there's a problem and don't know what to do. Well, there's no plan. Now you have to have a plan. And then once you have a plan, then you can implement the plan. And then you can look at your results. Just like everything we do, everything is evidence-based. You have to look at it, go through the process. Do a study, see if you did a good job. If you didn't, then we need to do something else. It just makes sense to me.
Thank you so much to my guest, nurse practitioner John Canyon. You can find a link to his entire report in the show notes of the podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to get the books Patients at Risk and Imposter Doctors. They're available on Amazon and at barnesandnoble.com. And if you're a physician, please consider joining the group Physicians for Patient Protection. We are a group that is fighting to protect physician-led care for all patients and truth and transparency among healthcare practitioners. You can learn more at our website, physiciansforpatientprotection.org. And if you have any interest in appearing as a guest on the podcast, please send me an email through patientsatrisk.com. Thanks so much, and we'll see you on the next podcast.